That's funny.
I would like to blame society. It says, should be here tonight by 10.
No, I think it's because we now have an Amazon distribution center in my town. So.
Oh my gosh. Probably left your town to get to mine.
I get things like the same day sometimes that are on Prime and you're supposed to have 2 days. Hi, welcome to the Backpack Show where we compare shipping rates for Amazon Prime based on your location.
This show is completely built around the idea that you should know more about Amazon Prime.
Apparently in Nashville, it's really fast.
How much is it a year now? Just $79? Is it still $79?
You think I check? I'm not going to cancel it.
So worth it.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Can't wait.
Oh my gosh. Welcome, William Smith. Good to see you here again. I don't know which link you're going to want today, but welcome.
Hey, be nice.
My biological father. You can have
any link he wants.
Stephen Brogan, his wife, Diane Brogan. So.
Hello. Welcome to the Backpack Show, where we bring you insights about success from unusual places. And today we have not just one, but two very fine authors.
We have all the authors today.
Well, we have Hillary Hawk. Two.
What's Hillary Hawk going to do? She's going to talk to us about...
You're so funny.
Some books.
She's going to talk to us about From Ashes to Song, which is her debut historical fiction novel. So we'll talk with her about that. I'm really excited. She's also like a translator. She's got many roles. She's really smart and I can't
wait. Speaks fluent Italian.
I know. I'm so excited. This is going to be fun. I was going to learn Italian for a trip that we didn't take because of the pandemic. I was going to supervise a whole bunch of eighth graders. On a trip to Italy and Greece. Doesn't that sound like the perfect thing for me to do? To keep youth out of trouble.
Sounds like a perfectly bad idea.
So I never learned Italian because I didn't need to because they canceled the trip. So I'm going to need a translator is what I'm saying. So I'm very excited Hillary's here. And Corinne Boley is here. She's a YA author and she's already done more at the age of 17 than I had ever dreamed of. I was telling her I never made it past like maudlin poetry when I was a teenager.
So five or more books up on Amazon or so.
It's crazy. I mean, I'm so excited. Darkness Rise is her YA fantasy novel. She's already got a novel under her belt, folks.
I'm telling you. There's a lot to get done over here.
Lots
it's a big
learn.
Day. Big day in the Backpack Show.
Hi, everyone. Tim Kitzer from NBA Jam and NFL Blitz. Welcoming you to the Backpack Show. Your hosts, Chris Brogan, Kerry Gorgone, Boom Shakalaka.
Backpack Show.
Boom Shakalaka.
You know, if you're William and you're wondering where you could go to make a show like this, I can tell you where. CBrogan.me/StreamYard. Hey, make a show. That's pretty good software. It's what we use. Hey, they had their big annual conference the other day. Did you see me on it? Me neither.
Hey, Castos.
Castos is a podcast host. If you want to put your podcast show up on there, and who wouldn't really? Castos.com.
It's funny. For all as much as people love video, like, they're still like, is it a podcast? Is it an audio podcast?
People keep calling it a podcast. I'm like,
they want audio. They just want whispering in their ear.
That's right.
Like ASMR.
We'll do an ASMR show.
I'll do it. I'm going
to
do it.
If you want a dot online domain, you can go to c.me/online.
Your mom is dot online is taken.
Hey, Ricardo's here. All right. So that's it. That's our ad reads for the day. So buy some things. Hi, Ricardo. Hey. I think we're going to start with Hillary Hawk and we're going to ask her some questions and, maybe she'll teach us.
Ricardo's checking in from Italy.
From Italy. Well, let's grab Hillary right away. All right, Hillary, get him. Say some things.
Get him.
What's some Italian we could say? You're live. Welcome to our show.
Oh, you're muted.
You are. If not muted, somehow muted.
Well, we'll fix it. Or she's speaking Italian and we can't even hear it.
Yeah, maybe it's only a sound dogs can hear.
Here's what we're going to do. We should have Hillary reset and come back.
We'll do that. Can you reset your computer for us, Hillary? Corinne, refresh magic. It. Boop.
Oh, you thought you were going to have a little break. We can hear
you
fine.
You thought we'd give you a break. Tasmania. Nope. Gerard's here from Tasmania. That's craziness. It's midnight there.
Do you speak any Tasmanian, Corinne?
Neither. Me neither.
What do they speak in Tasmania?
It's it's like part Australia and stuff like that. So they speak English.
Hello, Paul.
From the true center of the universe, Monaghan, Ireland.
Wow.
Corinne, we need to talk to you because we saw that you had this book, Darkness Rise, and we saw you kind of roaming out there talking about things. And for instance, our friend Katie Falls, who does a lot of YA reviews, I figured she needs to know a little bit about what's going on here. So Darkness Rise is kind of the new baby on the block for you. It's the one that you're out there promoting and putting all the work into. This is a not small book, by the way. It's a, you know, it's just under 200 pages if you grab it up in paper form. Talk to us a little bit about putting this together and talk about who needs to read this kind of a book.
What actually started out as a novella, and I just ended up lengthening it. So I guess everyone just wanted me to make it longer, and I kind of rushed through it. So I lengthened it from about 20,000 words to 56,000, I think.
You went an interesting route. The book is about a city where magic is banned. Most everybody goes to YA so they can go to the place where they can go do all the magic. And you're like, hey, I've got an idea. I'm going to make this restrictive. What was the premise there? And what ends up becoming the part that people fought you for until you made him a longer book?
Well, you know, you always want what you can't have. So I guess I wanted to make magic more desirable by making it something that was there, but something that wasn't easily accessible. So then it makes it more exciting when you do get the magic.
I haven't read the book, so I need to ask you this question up ahead, unless this is a spoiler. Is Swift just like a big jerk? Is that why like he doesn't want anybody to have magic? Or is it like, you know, when I was a kid, someone ran over my dog with a magic horse or something?
Well, when it first started out, it was very dangerous for humans to live in Mysticus. So the one who created the town was basically trying to protect humans, and he wanted to protect his family and his neighbors. So he basically just banned it because he wanted to keep everyone safe.
Gotcha.
That's usually where most lies begin, aren't they? Isn't it? Like, I just wanted to keep you safe. Like lies and other limitations. It's like for your own good.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that's the case sometimes? Like in your own life when people impose limitations and they say they're for your own good?
Yeah, definitely.
Rebellious streak.
YA and writing in general for teens is a little different than when I was growing up. When I was growing up, we had to use slate and we'd have to chip out the words with a hammer. No, but we didn't have things like Wattpad and we didn't have fandoms and things like that. Did you get your start in fandom and then work over to writing your own stuff? Or were you always kind of aiming towards, I want to make my own OC?
I went back and forth a lot. So when I first started, I was in fifth grade. And I was just writing short stories myself. I think that most of them were actually based on dreams that I had. And then when I found out about Wattpad, I started using it. But nothing was actually getting popular. And I think that was around the time that I found out that it was actually possible for me to publish something, even though I wasn't 18 yet. And I guess once that epiphany hit me that I didn't have to wait, I started doing as much research as I could, like reading everything that I could get my hands on about it. And then I started self-publishing, and then eventually I was able to publish with Darkstroke.
So there are people right now that have things they've written that are agonizing over hitting publish because they're worried about how it will be received, if anybody will read it, if anybody will say bad things about it. How did you get past that and just go ahead and publish?
I've actually always been surprised when people tell me that they're afraid to share their writing because I've spent my whole life trying to get people to read my writing. I'll bribe my brother. I'll say, I'll do your load of dishes if you read this. So I guess more excitement about it was there than fear about how people would react.
So share. Everybody should want to share.
There's a whole segment of YouTube called BookTube that, you know, mostly is all YA fans and all that sort of a thing. And they're back and forth on their favorite books. They're back and forth on up and coming. And they're back and forth talking about or posting videos about kind of the work they're doing. Are you part of that tribe at all as well? Or where do you go when you feel like talking about books instead of just working on your own writing?
I want to do more videos like that, honestly, but I tend to just write and not really talk about it unless it's just like with people in person, like a side subject. I guess because I'm so busy, or at least that's my excuse. I also don't get to read as much as I'd like to anymore. I don't know. I guess I just kind of focus on doing the actual writing instead of talking about it.
Which is why you have 5 books published on YouTube and a lot of people don't. Just FYI.
That's why some people have been working on their 10th book for like 6 years.
That's just debilitating depression, but
I haven't even published one, so, and I have no excuse.
Yeah. Corinne, there's always the more to an author than an author. In fact, you know, the way you can tell an author is that they do 76 other things a lot if they can help it. What are the other facets of you that we're not even going to guess about?
I'm very outdoorsy. So I have a lot of hobbies that revolve around the outdoors, like hunting and taxidermy and hiking and all that stuff, which is why I'm actually going to SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry in the fall to major in wildlife science. So
exciting. Taxidermy, that's an unusual hobby.
Yeah, I took lessons from a taxidermist. I haven't done it very much yet. I've done a few squirrels. Haven't worked with anything really big yet, but I'm hoping to.
Now, there's a couple different schools of that. Are you the kind that tries to make it a realistic life scenario, or do you put the squirrel in a cute hat and give them a coffee mug?
Feels disrespectful, right, Corinne? That's not nice.
I don't know. That is how a lot of people see SUNY SF. It's like, especially when it's next to Syracuse, which is a bigger school. So oh. It is kind of like the cute little brother. That's what they call it anyway.
So the people who would maybe make squirrel with hat would be a SUNY SF person. With regards to this book, they forced you into making it slightly longer. Does this kind of wet the whistle for you to make another longer book, or are you going to go back to novellas, or what's the plan with that?
I honestly go around a lot. Like right now I'm in the middle of writing about 3 different novels. And then also I'm hoping to write a novella to follow up one of my other novellas, Dear Jackson. Although I actually was considering turning that into a novel as well and republishing it and then doing that as a novel series. It's really just difficult to, I don't know about to publish novellas really, but it's definitely difficult to get novellas published traditionally, which I want to start doing more. So that's why I'm thinking it might be better to focus on novels for now.
How do you know when a dream is just a dream versus when a dream is like the start of something big, like a novel?
I guess when I can't stop thinking about it, I always come back to it.
That makes a lot of sense. Hillary, our other author backstage, is nodding her head off with you. So it's really kind of fun to see it resonate. One thought I had when I was, you know, kind of looking over your various works and all that is that to get the attention of somebody and have them say they're going to publish something, are they betting on the space because the YA genre is the hottest it's ever been? Are they betting on you? How much do you have to please these people for them to say, Corinne, anything you want to publish, we're here for you now. Like, what's that interaction been like?
It's really hard. Like when you publish, at least for me, like when I published my first thing, Darkness Rise, non-self-published. It's sort of like if you don't make a lot of sales in the beginning, people, I don't know if they assume that your work isn't going to make a lot of sales afterward, but that does make it a lot harder for people to have faith in your other works. I don't know if that's the same with other people, but that's the experience that I've
had. Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is. It seems like. But don't worry, because Paul just bought yours.
Thank you.
And Carol said, do you have a writing ritual? Like, do you write at a certain time of day?
I go through phases where I will make myself get up early, but I'm very bad at getting up early. I can't really follow through. I'll just go back to sleep. So depending on how motivated I am on the current day, I'll try to get up early and write before I have to do schoolwork. But usually I just end up writing whenever I get a chance to.
Does it chase you around? Like if you have an idea for something, you know, does it kind of distract you from your work during the day until you can get it down?
I will get very distracted. I've had times where I kind of negotiated with myself where if I finish a certain amount of work by lunchtime, then I can write for an hour and then go back to working. So I'll do things like that. It definitely does distract me a lot.
Coach Woodard has the question, does writing about your dreams help bring any kind of resolution or better understanding of them?
I think the only problem with writing about my dreams is that sometimes it'll kind of twist the dream and I'll remember it in a way that it wasn't actually true, I guess. So like I'll write about it and then I'll realize that something that I wrote, I actually made up. And it'll get to the point when I can't remember what's dream and what's writing.
It all springs from the same well, though.
That's true.
Your imagination.
You are heading towards college, and that means even more workload put on you. Are you worried that's going to shut you down as an author and there it goes, everything's over, the dream's over, you're done?
Well, I've actually been taking online college classes for 2 years. So I've been doing college work, just not doing it in person.
Got it.
So that has prepared me for it, I think. But I'm also kind of nervous since I'll actually be there that the workload might be a bit harder. Plus, obviously, like it's more advanced now. So I think I might end up having to take a step back from not from writing for fun, but from writing and being expected to publish more often. So I'll probably write when I can, but not really force myself to as much.
Elizabeth asks, do you ever dictate or do you strictly write? Like, do you type? Do you write? How do you get it done?
When I have writer's block, I do use a speech to text app sometimes, because then I can just sort of talk through ideas and I'll get more ideas. So that's one of the ways that I cure writer's block, which I actually get a lot more than I think I probably should. But I usually try to write if I can.
Like handwrite or type?
Typing.
I had a typewriter, and I'm not going to tell you how long ago that was, but long enough that I didn't have an option. That's like very exciting. It could hold one line of text in the like memory of the electric typewriter. But that's how I learned to do it. So actually handwriting for me is harder for creative things.
I have two typewriters, but yeah. They're very loud, so I usually don't use them.
I was the same. Well, I learned how to write. My parents made me take a typing course in eighth grade and so that I could type on a computer. But it's interesting the difference I find. You know, you mentioned Wattpad and all that. Are you a person who did a lot of your writing on your phone, or are you a person who does writing on a laptop or tablet? I ask because I feel like the ideas you have are shaped by the mechanical device you're using. I'm curious to know your take.
Yeah, I cannot type on a phone. I don't know. I have to use a laptop or a desktop, or I mean, sometimes I'll write by hand, but I cannot type on a phone.
I can't do it when I'm doing just text, never mind something that's supposed to have like an actual like through line, a plot or anything. Carol has several questions. Have your parents had a role in encouraging or inspiring your writing?
Well, my mom actually taught me to read when I was, I think, just when I turned 4. And my dad actually used to write when he was a teenager. He sadly stopped, but I'm trying to convince him to co-write a book with me. And we started it last year. It's a twist on Peter Pan, like a little bit darker, a little bit more adult, I guess. So I'm trying to convince him to keep doing that. But overall, they have been very supportive and helpful. And they'll always post about my books on Facebook and try to get our family to share them and buy them and all that.
And how old were you when you wrote your first book? Now let's count everything. Let's count like novellas and stuff in that.
I wrote my first novel when I was 15. My first novella when I was, I want to say 13, I think. And then I was writing short stories when I was 10.
So there's still time. Still time, Carol. Were you a voracious reader when you were younger? I feel like you have to be. But
yeah, definitely. I actually, once when I was in second grade, my parents were called in to talk to my teacher because she wanted to tell them that during free time, I was reading and I was so stuck in the book that I wouldn't hear when it was time to be done. So everyone would have cleaned up all the stuff that they were using and gone and sat back down in their desks and I would still be reading. And she was very angry at me about that for some reason, my teacher.
My parents didn't care at all that my teacher said the same thing. My parents were like, huh, okay.
Can you imagine that's a thing to be mad about? She's reading.
Yeah. Wham. How dare she?
Unbelievable. Corinne, it's always weird to get asked by absolute strangers onto a video show. Like, I know it doesn't happen every week for you. What did you do to muster up the courage to be a guest? You know, people are scared to death to come on this camera. Like, how did you do it? How did you muster up and say, I can do this. I got this.
I might have read a few articles about how to calm down before a live thing. I'm not really good at it in general. I hate, I won't even watch live shows usually because I'm afraid for the people on the show. I'm thinking they're going to mess up. I don't want to see them mess up. But
we do. We mess up every day, Corinne. Every day. And it doesn't matter at all.
But that's the anxiety button for you, though, right? Is that sense of if there's some kind of a what's the word I want? When someone feels kind of humiliated in some way, that's your, even if it's someone else, that's a trigger for you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I also, I tend to have sympathy pain in general. So I think that probably adds to it.
Well, we only invite people on the show that we love. So the conversations are very positive and uplifting and we celebrate you. So
kind of can't mess it up. No. Well, I'm glad you came on. Listen, we got to stick you backstage, but thank you so much for giving a lot of people something to think about. You're doing an awesome job, says Carol. You don't seem nervous at all.
Thank you. I kind of feel a little nervous still, but that's okay.
No, if
no one else notices, then that's fine. Although it has been pretty fun. So
good.
We're that's having part a great that matters time. To me. So.
All right, kicking you backstage. Shh. See you in a minute. Boop. Now we go from this to another of the equation. We grab Hillary Hawk.
Go get the book.
We'll see if we can hear something this time. Part two, Hillary. Hello.
Hello. Are you there?
Yes, your dulcet tone is
let loose to the world.
Everyone's like, I didn't know she was British. I would have waited for that.
I can't believe anybody would have left listening to Corinne. She was wonderful. Well,
wasn't she? Isn't she? She's still back there. We'll bring her back out at the end. So, man, so accomplished. I'm sitting here like, what was I doing at 13? Not a damn thing. Nothing worth talking about today.
You mentioned, Hillary, that I saw a lot of head nodding, because you're also an author and your most recent that we're promoting here is From Ashes to Song. Before we dig all the way through into yours, I just wanted to know just how much you resonated with all the stuff that you heard there.
Oh, absolutely. A few things, particularly when Corinne said that those stories that won't let go. I have a lot of ideas and I write them down feverishly, but some I don't even need to write down because they murmur to you constantly. And just the journey. What I can't say resonates with me is writing at that age, because I was telling stories and I tried to write at that age, but I didn't have the confidence. So I just set it aside and I actually made a pledge that I would get back to writing when I was old and wise. And old and wise for me was like 40 years old.
So. I'm still waiting for wise any day now.
Yeah. Well, I don't know when wise happened, but 40 is not old. So.
No.
The book From Ashes to Song is set in starts in a vineyard, and all of this kind of experience happens this thing that he loves, this life that he loves, this space that he, Pietro has around him, he has to set fire to the vineyard. There's a problem. The world is, has a problem now. And so everything comes from that, but that's the catalyst. Is there a historical thing to this? Is this from a real event, or what made us make this the focus launching point of the story?
I have to say this. I wrote especially this part of the story way before the pandemic. In fact, the whole story was written before the pandemic. But it is a disease that is going through the vineyards, and it's a real disease. It's called Phylloxera, and it started in Europe, in France, but it was originally from the US. And the disease was actually carried on the tiny louse that would attack the vineyards. And the way that they tried to stop the spread of it throughout Europe was to burn the vineyards, kind of to form a barrier. But it didn't work. And actually, most of the vines, most of the world are grafted onto American roots that are resistant to the disease. But I did take a little bit of a liberty because records aren't very tight in Italy on when it actually swept through. It probably swept through a little bit earlier than when I've actually sent it.
Oh, so you have to take a little like artistic license so that your story elements line up.
For sure, yes.
So you're a translator, you're a writer, photographer, just a creative person overall. When did this novel kind of take root in your mind as something you needed to create?
Well, as I said, I tried to write when I was a teenager and swept that aside. So I thought 40 was a great age to become a novelist. So I started writing at about 38, which if anybody's out there considering a novel, 2 years is not enough. So I am now 50 and finally seeing this book in print. But I was trying to write a different story at that time. And I had recently moved to the US, but not from the UK. I lived in Italy for 12 years in near Milan before I came here. And when I got here, it really wasn't the hey, there's a book. It really wasn't the US I expected to find. You know, I had seen America on the in the movies, you know, New York and Chicago and Miami, and I came to a coal mining town. And, you know, it was nothing like what I expected whatsoever. But I was just captivated by this town. It was very much carried the flavor of when it was originally built in the 1910s. And everybody in the town had a story. So they had a grandparent or a parent or great grandparents who were off the boat and had an immigrant story. And they liked to tell me because, well, I like listening to stories, but also because I was an immigrant myself. And then I met a lady called Irene Smilnicki, and she actually gave me this necklace, which is a 100 lira. So
very I want special. A closer look. Hold on, let me make your banner away.
Little good luck charm. So anyone who remembers the lira, that's a, oh, 500 lira, sorry, not 100. And she started telling me the story of her parents, and I was just captivated. And then I asked her if I could write her story, and she didn't miss a beat. She just said, yes, I've always thought it would be a great novel. So that's how it started.
In the process of doing all this, there's a lot of, similar to a question we asked Corinne, there's a lot of courage that has to happen. There's going to be a lot of people who are going to explain to you why you're not an author or why you're not, you know, something. You're wrong in some way, Hillary. How'd you push through? How'd you champion your own cause?
Well, I guess I kind of cut off for that, but I found that to be the case in the outer world, but it wasn't a terrible issue for me. But early on, I found a writing community, especially in Pen Writers, which is a organization for writers based in Pennsylvania. So I had a lot of writer friends, and they faced the same issues. So that wasn't the problem. I actually found the biggest fear and the biggest limitation came from within me, not from other people saying I couldn't do it. It was very, very hard to get over. Now I know it's called imposter syndrome. I didn't know at the time, but fear held me back for a long time.
Imposter syndrome. Yeah. I'm just thinking, Corinne didn't even have time for that. It was like, oh, my book's already out. So yes. I'm a published author. I did it.
I shall be an imposter later.
I did it. Yeah, exactly. I'll save that for another career.
You mentioned something that had sort of an echo to it, which is that you said, you know, the town that you found yourself in here is from the 1910s. And of course, this story starts in 1911, I think it was. So is that a sort of writing? Is your soul drawn to that time period for some reason, right before the Great War and all that? What gets us there?
Wow. I don't know. I think I'm fascinated by different areas rather than that particular area. I'm really drawn to that area because I almost felt like I'd moved into it by coming here. But yeah, I was actually trying to write a World War II story at that time. But I think the 1910s is, you know, there are lots of World War II stories, but there aren't so many stories set in the 1910s. But it's a great opportunity, especially with a great wave of immigration. You know, my character Pietro is a musician. He's a composer and a clarinetist, and he was really gifted. And I just can't imagine all the people who came over in that period who bought gifts and customs. And it's a good time to look back at and see, you know, when people came over, there was a lot of separation of people depending on where they came from, and over time, you know, the Italians were segregated with the Eastern Europeans, although there was a difference between Northern Italians and Southern Italians. The Welsh were on the honorable side of town, if you like. So I think it's a good idea to go back and revisit those times. I think, you know, we can learn a lot for today's world.
Corinne backstage says one of her current projects is a World War II story.
Wonderful.
Look at this. Mm-hmm. You debuted your book, as I can understand it, just this month, which means that you put the book right out during the pandemic. Good timing, Hillary.
Yay.
having a
wait for it to be over.
I've been published a whole bunch of traditional books. It's hard to get attention. It's hard to get press. It's hard to get people to care. What did you do to go above and beyond to try to get people to come and find this book, seeing as you couldn't wander every independent bookstore in the greater Pennsylvania region?
Well, the book was actually delayed by the pandemic. I signed with Sunbury Press in February, and we were hopeful for last year for it to be published. So it was set back quite a long way. But yeah, I think the mindset now is to go for the long haul. Corinne mentioned that when you get a book out initially, there's a lot of expectation on initial sales. But that's absolutely right. But I'm not going to sit back and, you know, let things go. We've got great opportunities with online events. And I am actually starting to do some events locally in bookshops. Some are opening up socially distanced. I have a library event, which I'm really excited about. They built an outdoor patio, and I think I'm going to be the first person to present on their outdoor patio. So
that's exciting. Well, make sure those bricks are even. Definitely don't want to fall flat on your face. Carol has a question. Is it challenging as a woman to write from the male perspective?
That's a very interesting question. I
wonder how many male authors field that question. Like, hey, is it hard to write from a female perspective? They're like, no, I got it.
Be interesting to hear a male reader if he can, if Pietro resonates. But I actually found him almost easier to write than Assunta, who's a female character. I think it depends how much you can climb into their skin and understand them. So he is a gifted musician, a composer, and a coal miner. Of course, I've never been a coal miner. And my only claim to fame on the singing side, I came third in a singing contest once, but it was, the contest was for the worst singer. So.
Oh, well done.
So that was really, really hard, but I kind of had a really clear image of him. As a person on stage, he was brilliant and captivating, but in person, he would rarely say a word. So I imagined him interacting with the world through sound, not through visuals, as most of us interact with the world. I think that really helped me climb into his skin. So that wasn't really an issue.
So interesting, though, because you're a photographer, so you are very visual. So he's very different from you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he didn't have much courage either. He had this inner fear as well. So on that level, I could really relate.
And there's two layers to that, because he also worked in a vineyard where smell is so important. That's, mm-hmm. A great mass of his effort would have had to have been in smell. And so he says, I will use my ear. As his gift and all that. So that's quite interesting too, just that he evaded your visual choices that you have for Hillary herself. It's a little early for us to be plotting out your next five books, but when you put a book like this out there, is there immediately the sense that there must be a next book and a third? And what's the mindset behind how you're going to make this a business empire?
Well, the best way to sell a book is to write another. And I actually have one that's in the final revision stage. So I hope to be pitching that soon. And then I'm working on a third, and I have a few more ideas. I was actually going to write, I was convinced of the next book I was going to write before the pandemic hit, but it was too dreary. It's post-apocalyptic. So
nobody wants that right now.
No, I couldn't bear to write it.
That's actually my fiction genre of choice. And I felt the same way you just said, which was there's no way I want to release a post-apoc book right now because we're living it. So
is historical fiction different than other types? Like, will your other books also be historical fiction?
Well, the second book that I'm finishing up now is set in 1964. So I guess you could put it near historical, but I think it's more accurately classified as women's fiction. I have three.
We'll ask Corinne if that qualifies as historical. When she comes back out.
Or maybe from her perspective, yeah.
I know my kids are like, they think the 90s was like the ancient times. So right. Anytime before everyone had a phone in their hand, it's like we all had stone tablets. That's how it goes.
For sure.
So, So your second book, how did the inspiration hit you for that? Like, did you, for the first, From Ashes to Song, you mentioned you met someone and their family story inspired you. So how did the second one hit you?
Well, it's really based on a universal truth that nobody is who they say they are. And we were going on a motorbike trip. My husband rides a motorbike, and I used to ride on the back. I won't anymore because he had an accident. So, but we rode up to the Adirondacks, and I had a lot of time to sit there and think. And I decided I was going to see if I could come up with a storyline based on nobody is who they say they are. And that's how the plot came about.
The book now, though, the current book is the way people talk about it. There's a massive amount of work inside of emotional struggle that, you know, as people are engaging in this book, you think a lot about probably your own relationships and how this kind of fight goes back and forth, and just how there's never, like, you never give these people a break. It's from out of the frying pan throughout the entire book. Right. Why did you do that?
Why? What did you do that to them? You're like, no judgment, but why'd you do that to them?
Actually, a lot of the story is inspired, is actually true. So the births, deaths, and marriages are all true. So that is really the reality that they were living.
So you didn't choose to kill off a character. People just actually died.
Right. And I did vow in my second book, if I can get a reprieve, not to kill anybody. And I don't. Kind of balanced it out a little bit. But the emotional struggle, we don't know anything about their emotional journey. So that tied the fiction together. That was what I had to create.
Hillary, as people are thinking about this, and as you've worked with lots of writers groups, my experience with writers groups has been a mixed bag. There's it's a place for some people to hang out who will never push publish. It's their sort of weird solve that lets them feel like they're doing something. For other people, it is exactly what they need to get the book out there. You want to give us your quick take on writers groups and how to maybe evaluate one so that you know that you're in the right group?
Oh, gosh. I think I've been lucky, and I found groups that have been supportive. Well, Penwriters is an organization that prides itself on paying it forward and really supporting others. My second writing group from that I actually created because there wasn't one in my area. So I carried that mindset. I don't really know how to give advice on that. If you go in,
well, what are your rules?
You just got lucky.
How do you just set up your writing group then? What is it? What does it have to do for the people that you serve?
Well, one thing I said from the very beginning is there's enough rejection out there. There's enough negativity, so we're not going to have any in the group. And I actually had a little bell, you know, from a hotel. And if anyone got negative, I would have to press the button, but I never pressed it. I just told them I would.
So. I love
it. It's a good threat. It's a good threat. Good. It's time on our show to grab Corinne back. And just as I said that, I lost all control of the buttons. We're going to talk.
Me too.
Corinne, are you in a writer's group as well?
I was, but then it stopped because of COVID.
Yes. Wouldn't want to bring the plague to your fellow authors.
No, for sure not.
Do you advocate for writer's groups, do you think, Corinne?
It definitely was helpful in my case. I was the youngest by far, and they were really helpful to me. And I did get to go and like read my stuff every week and listen to other people's work. It was kind of sad when it ended. I'm hoping that we'll be able to start again.
I was, soon, we hope, right? Let's vaccinate the writers first. I mean, priorities, people.
We need to keep her.
Because if we don't have books, we won't have movies. And if we don't have movies, we won't have movies. So.
You've heard each other be interviewed now. What resonated or didn't with each other's interview?
I'm wondering how you did historical fiction. Because, I mean, I've tried historical fiction and I've had such a hard time because I'll be writing and then I'll think, oh wait, this detail might not be right. And then I'll research for an hour, finish the sentence, and then just do it over and over again. So I'm kind of curious as to how you did that.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I started this book 12 years ago. So there is a lot of work to do. I read a lot of books. I lived in Italy and I came over here. So I had a good sense myself of the locations, but what was actually happening at that time in Italy, what was happening in the US, it took a lot of research. So yes, it does take a long time. So
we interviewed Nicole Glover, who wrote The Conductors, which is another historical fiction novel about the about people leading the Underground Railroad, but there's magic involved. So some people have magic, whole different universe. But she kind of immersed herself in it for months and months before she ever tried to begin writing. Like, she learned a lot about the era first and tried. So she kind of tried to come at it from a different point. Like, I'm going to, like, immersion therapy, get in immersed in this way, time.
I was thinking of another of the authors we talked to who said she spent a massive amount of time researching things like the cockpit on a Spitfire. That was our person who helped out with the, what's that show that everybody likes, Carrie, that she was the consultant on?
Are you thinking about Sharon Paul?
Nope. The nice lady who's British, who, nice lady. the royalty expert.
Oh yeah. I loved her. Catherine Curzon.
Thank you. I knew you'd know it. So she's writing a book with a fellow.
She specializes. She's like a royalty historian specializing in the Georgian period era. But
she said, we spent a lot of time studying the instrument panels of Spitfires. And I said, that doesn't sound like something that's going to have a lot of pages in your historical fiction book. She goes, no. She just said it became almost like a what's the word I want? Like that became the hobby. So I guess that's a question back. Is historical fiction for people who are super passionate about a certain time period?
I think you have to have some level of passion. Absolutely. If it's a period that doesn't interest you, then you're not going to want to spend the hours, because you really do need to spend a lot of time there trying to understand, you know, what made people tick back then.
I feel like you need a focus group, Hillary. You need to just bang out a draft and put it in a private group somewhere and let all those people who are super into it rip it to shreds. And then
that's not how that happens.
Yeah. Then you just fix it before anybody sees it.
I find it very hard to be patient and do research before writing. I just want to do the writing part.
That really surprises me, because you have dragons and fantasy. So you've created a world.
Yes. Yeah. You make up the rules.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
But that means you also have to maintain the control of the rules, because the one thing you could do wrong in fantasy or sci-fi is if you break the rules, your reviewers will kill you. That's a murder.
Yeah. They do get fussy. Yeah, so. The persnickety.
Hey, I've got something.
Oh, and here's our person of the day. Kaboom!
Because believe it or not, our show is already at its end.
I don't know who you could pick. I don't know.
Gee, only one person has 76 questions. So I'm going to give it to Carol. Carol, thank you. Good job. And thank you for asking those questions. There's a lot of important things that a lot of people here also was feeling. And also, Carol's the one who reminded us it was Bridgerton that I was not remembering, because I don't watch those shows. Don't
now,
care.
Corinne, if I were to say to Carol, you have so many questions, why don't you just pop in with us and ask Corinne yourself? She would be like, absolutely not. So there's definitely people who want to be on camera and people who don't. Either is fine. But for what it's worth, you're dynamite. You did amazing.
You did it. All right. People backpack. Of Earth, this is it. This is the last question. What goes in your backpack? It could be something physical. It could be something metaphorical. It could be something for the ages. It's just, what are you going to take with you to kind of make the next 5 years work better? Carrie, for instance, what's a great example of a physical thing that could go into a backpack?
Extra set of teeth.
An extra set of teeth, clearly.
That was DJ Cumberbund, a remix artist on YouTube, and he said that, and I was like, what? And so it stuck with me ever since.
No one has since answered something like extra set of teeth.
No, though. It's so good. I mean, people have said, like, a good whiskey, or, you know, the Bible, or, like, all sorts of things, different
An
things.
An avocado.
Yeah, avocado. Yes, that was a member of Clowns Without Borders, like a theatrically trained clown that goes into disaster areas when invited, when they need people to, like, cheer up the community. And Saida Trujillo said an avocado. So, that makes sense. Good, healthy fats.
Yeah. What's a good metaphorical thing people could add to their backpack, Carrie?
Kindness.
That's a great one.
I also liked pride. Horacio Garcia Rojas from the Netflix series Diablero had said pride, like in where he comes from. So I love that.
Devils and Demons Roaming Mexico City, Call Our Man Elvis, who is played by Horacio. So now we get to ask you two the question. Corinne Boley, what goes in the backpack?
The first thing that came to mind for me was tenacity, for metaphorical anyway, because no matter what you're doing, I think that's the thing that you need the most. It works that for is, different things.
That's a popular one, and it's a good one to put in there. And I think we get it about every 8 or so episodes. I think we should hope to keep that up because I think it's a super important one. And clearly, you know, you're going back to rewrite your horse book, and you've got all these other things you got to get done, and you're getting ready to finish, you know, go full bore into college any day now. So,
and without that, nothing gets done. You can have all the talent and imagination you want. If you don't sit down and do the thing, it's not getting done.
Tenacity is a powerful one. Hillary Hawk, what are you throwing in the backpack?
Can I throw an action?
Sure. Chris makes the rules.
Action's grand. I think it's a perfect thing to put in. Cool. And it's sometimes sorely missing in writing, isn't it? When you sometimes go back and look at words, and I think everyone's been sitting at the kitchen table for 41 pages. Maybe let's have someone move.
Okay. So my action is to show up. Because, yeah, whether it's at a writer's meeting or in your community or at an event, to show up and you wouldn't run a marathon without preparing. So everything you do leading up, you know, show up. You might not know why you're going to an event or joining a writer's group, but it'll make sense in the end.
Your countryman, Eddie Izzard, ran 40 marathons in a row on his 40th birthday, 40 days in a row. 40 marathons, and he'd never run more than a few kilometers at a time. He said it almost killed his body, but he thought, why not? Let's see if it's hard. And it was hard. I like it. I really like your plan. So it's a good one. Showing up is important. Presence is very important. Late 20th century philosopher Kanye West said, my presence is a present. And then he went on to say, kiss my ass. I don't know what that was about. I think he was feeling grumpy. Oh, dear. But I think, you know, my grandmother read a lot of romance books, but she read a lot of historical fiction because of that as well. So I think she would have liked at least one of our guests today, maybe both.
She would have liked them both.